I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, President Obama will head again to Capitol Hill to meet with both parties and push his stimulus bill. Some Republicans are saying there's too much spending. Some financial analysts are responding there's not enough. And Obama outlined another aspect of his plan this morning, signing executive orders he called a down payment on a new energy economy, paving the way for states to set tougher rules on car emissions. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of the ABC political blog The Note. Rick, let's start with this stimulus package fight. Republicans want more tax cuts. They're critical of Obama driving up the national debt with spending. But economists like Paul Krugman are saying, remember FDR, you know, he didn't want to spend it first either, but that's the only way out of this economy. So why are Republicans asking for more cuts? Do they really believe in them? And why is Obama entertaining the cuts?
Two reasons. Right now we're in a delicate stage of negotiation where Obama needs this to be a bipartisan bill. He doesn't want this to be Democrats only. So that gives Republicans some sway in all of this. And I think from the Republican perspective, they are sort of rediscovering their commitment to fiscal discipline after years where President Bush led them down a road that I don't think they thought was successful electorally. They feel like they need to get back to the principles of low taxes and low spending. So when they see a $1 trillion package on the table, they want to see as much of that go to tax cuts as opposed to spending increases as possible. So I think it's more about the politics and less about the economics.
Well, but, you know, some might say, you know, we know that President Obama wants to be, you know, the post-partisan president, but these are serious times. Is it worth it catering to the Republicans if, in fact, he really believes, you know, that we're in the state we're in and tax cuts won't work?
That is the critical question facing the Obama folks right now. How hard do they want to go to make this a bipartisan bill? Are they willing to compromise core principles? It's possible to get Republicans to vote for this package in large numbers, but it's going to mean putting out a package that looks like what Republicans would want. And they're under no obligation to vote for this at all. It could be that when it comes to the House floor, every single Republican votes against this on Wednesday. Then again, President Obama can put some pressure on Democratic leaders to give in to Republicans in some of these areas, get some Republican votes. But if they believe, if the Obama folks, if the House leaders believe that this package as written right now is the best one, that's exactly where policy and politics come into conflict.
Right. Well, right now the plan offers a $1,000 tax cut for 95% of American families and lots of money for rebuilding, improving roads and transit. But you point out there's also almost $1 million for a disc golf course in Austin. I'd never heard of such a thing. It's Frisbee and golf. Apparently a dog park in California. So are Republicans right? Is there pork spending here?
There is going to be spending that some people consider pork. All spending meets that definition under some way. Even though there's not going to technically be any earmarks, there's a big effort going on in Washington and beyond to make sure this money goes to areas that that lawmakers favor, that local leaders favor. You can't spend this much money without having a lot of projects spended. But as is always, one person's pork is someone else's necessary, essential, vital spending for the furtherance of the American system of government.
And by the way, John Boehner, House Majority Leader, a Republican, objected to increased funding for contraceptives under Medicaid. But why are Democrats defending that in the bill?
Medicaid is a big budget buster in state budgets, and this money that's directed for states is going to have a big impact to helping them. And the fact that it's set aside for contraceptive programs is very controversial, but this is a budget buster for states that need some help.
They need the money. Well, let's just briefly touch on the fact this morning that President Obama ordered the EPA to let California and 13 other states set tougher auto emission standards. Now, that helps the environment, but how does that help the economy?
Well, it may not, and not in the short term, certainly. The Republicans are already making some noise about this, saying that this is going to make it harder for Detroit to compete. It's going to make it more difficult. They may have to come to Washington for another bailout if they have to go by these standards in California and a number of other states. It is part of the broader push, though, that Barack Obama has talked about with green jobs and energy initiatives that do help the economy. This is a critical first step, something he can do by fiat as opposed to having to wait for legislation on it. But you're right. I think there's real questions to be asked about the short-term economic benefit. The Obama folks would argue this is about broader principles than that.
Well, could it also be, in the few seconds we have, in fact, saving the car industry from itself, forcing them to step into the future and save themselves?
That's part of the argument, is that Washington needs to goose along the automakers to force them to start producing the kind of cars that people want to buy and that are good for the environment.
That's Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of the ABC political blog, The Note. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, today we want to take a deep look at daycare with Penelope Leach. Her 1978 book, Your Baby and Child, changed the way millions of parents raise their kids. But her take on daycare has been controversial. Working moms felt betrayed by her in the 1990s when Dr. Leach pushed for mother care over daycare. Now her new book, Child Care Today, Getting It Right for Everyone, takes a closer look with maybe a changed attitude. Penelope Leach joins us from a BBC studio in Brighton, England. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Why is this such a gut-wrenching, charged issue, child care?
It is, I think, the major conundrum of the century. I know that sounds extreme, but I think the whole business of how parents can be in two places at once, which most of us have never learnt to be, and be really hitting a family-friendly balance between working and caring. How much time do I spend earning money to spend on my child, and how much time do I spend being with my child? I think this is something that's, we'd call it the elephant in the corner. Do you have that expression?
Sure, elephant in the living room.
Elephant in the living room. We fiddle with it. We talk about it a lot. Media talk about it a lot. We don't actually face the fact that we need to resolve it in some more basic way.
Well, then I don't think parents struggling with these questions that you just started to list would think at all you're overdoing it to say that it's such a big issue. It's a huge issue. And I want to get something right on the table. You wrote the 1994 book, Children First.
Yep.
Now, many people thought the takeaway from that book was that young children that spend extended periods of time in daycare are at risk, emotionally or psychologically. And
yep.
A lot of working moms at that time thought that that book was an attack. What is your overarching thought about daycare in this new book?
Okay. That book was written in the mid-90s. Talking about now, in this new millennium, we have a situation where children's needs haven't changed, or babies and young children need to be cared for by a caring grown-up every hour of every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for at least 10 years. That's a huge commitment. The question is, who's going to do it? And what's changed is that where that used to be kind of almost taken for granted mom, now it isn't. And it isn't just because mothers, women, want to be in the workplace. It is because modern economies can't possibly exist without all healthy adults working and earning.
So Penelope Leach, I just want to make sure, it sounds like you've changed your mind. It sounds like you were saying in Children First that a caring mom had to be present for those years, and it sounds like you're now saying maybe she can't be, but also you are now pointing to research that shows that it's not as much who it is that loves the child, but that the child be loved.
Yes, 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 a million times yes. All the research shows that that relationship, they call it attachment if we're being posh about it, is more important to that child's well-being for years to come than anything about the childcare. And it isn't so much that I've changed my mind as that society has changed. If you've got a community, not society, but a community, a street, where the ordinary thing is for parents or a parent to be home with a kid until he's 3-4 years old and begins to go to school, then that's going to be the way that feels right, feels normal. But if you've got a street like we have today where that's a very unusual thing to do, then it's quite different for the parent. And being a full-time mom at home now is something which a lot of people find very difficult, and if they find it difficult, they don't often do it terribly well. What women want is absolutely crucial to the well-being of children.
Well, and in fact, you point to researchers who say that a mother who is not happy but is at home is as likely to have lasting ill effects on a young child as a mother being separated from a child.
Yes, yes. So if you're in a not very good childcare nursery, but you've got a wonderful relationship going on at home, you're better off than if the relationship at home's a bit dicey and you're in a brilliant childcare.
Well, that's fascinating. Tell us more, though. Okay, so it's if you have a good relationship at home but not such a good daycare, that's still okay?
Well, it's better than the other way around. Of course, it's not ideal. But what that message, what I've just said, really means is that having enough time to forge those bonds, to get to know that baby, to get dare I use that term, attached to it, which is a mutual thing, so that you've got that baby somewhere in your mind all the time, even when you're at work, you've got some bit of your mind that's always with that child. To get that established, people need time. And to some of us, and I don't want to be rude, I'm on American radio here and conscious of it and grateful, but some of us are very horrified to hear about the ages at which some American babies have to go into full daycare, because we do find it amazing that that should be taking place maybe even before 3 months.
Well, let's explain why. The U.S. government offers mothers no paid maternity leave. They might get it from work, but they don't get any help from the government. Mm-hmm. And it only requires that companies offer 3 months of unpaid leave. So you're saying at 3 months, many of these children are going off. But what happens in other countries?
I have to start by saying that the United States is the only post-industrial Western country that gives no federally mandated maternity or familial leave at all. The only one. It is shocking. The whole of Europe, Canada, New Zealand do.
And how much do they give?
The sort of average is round about 9 months.
9 months?
Yeah. And
is it paid leave?
Yeah. And that's terribly important. In fact, if maternity leave's unpaid, most people won't take it. But even if the money's not very much, and here, I mean, it's like $120 a week here in the UK that mothers get, and that's not enough to live on. But even if that money is not very much, everybody will take all they're entitled to. And the reason, I think, is something to do with feeling respected, feeling honoured, feeling that it's socially okay to take 6 months or even 9 months off from your professional job to rear this baby.
It has dignity attached to it.
It has dignity, exactly, yeah. Thank you. That's exactly the word I was looking for. The UK, although it's improved hugely since 1997, isn't nearly as good on this as some of the European countries, particularly, of course, Scandinavia. One of the reasons the Scandinavian countries can provide such excellent childcare is that they hardly provide any for babies. Babies are almost all at home with their mothers or their fathers because there's paternity and maternity leave for at least a year. So that's very expensive to provide daycare for babies in the first year. So the fact that they hardly have to do that means that that money, that taxpayers' money, goes into excellent care later. In the second and third years.
Again, because the babies stay home. Well, let's give the details of those Scandinavian countries, details of the parental leave that other governments provide. In Sweden, mothers get 13 months off and receive 80% of their full-time salary. And in Norway, parents can get a year off at 80% of their salary. And in both those countries, parents can then get additional time off at lower rates of pay. We're speaking with British psychologist Penelope Leach. Her new book is Child Care Today, Getting It Right for Everyone. And just ahead, so what should a parent do when looking for a daycare provider? And later today, do you donate your used clothing to American charities? In so doing, you may be truly helping someone in Haiti. We'll be back with Penelope Leach in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with renowned childcare expert Penelope Leach. Her new book is Child Care Today, Getting It Right for Everyone. And she says good daycare is a moral imperative. But how to start? Penelope, when our colleague Kevin Sullivan and his wife Lucia tried to find daycare for their infant, they found an Italian grandmother running a center in her home, but Lucia didn't know what to ask her. Mm-hmm. And she asked this woman, trying to sound very official, "What is your child care philosophy?" Yeah. And the woman seemed confused. She said, "It's a baby. We love the baby. We kiss the baby." It seems like you, Penelope Leach, are saying that's your answer.
Well, the first year, I'd be very happy with a loving Italian grandmother myself, provided I liked her and she liked me.
Because, again, just to reinforce, what you're looking for is love, is someone who will be that thing that an infant needs. And the key people, they're called, these key people outside the mother.
Key people, and the trick to being the key person, the good key person, is above all sensitive and responsive, which sounds a little more official than love. I mean, it comes to the same thing, let's face it. But sensitive in the sense of aware of what the baby's feeling like and thinking about and trying to do and so on. And responsive in the sense, if you watch somebody with a baby like 5 months old and she smiles at the baby and the baby very, very, very slowly begins to smile back. And if you're watching, you can see this going on. The unresponsive person will have turned away and got on with something else before that baby's got round to smiling.
So there's that first element. But tell us, what else should someone look for in a childcare provider outside the home?
Well, if you're looking for a child who's a little older, you're looking above all for not only a high ratio, like at least one adult to, say, three toddlers, but you need to go look what's going on. Often we were told this was the ratio in this room, the three adults to 12 children, say. But when we got in there, one was taking a coffee break, one had got a bit late coming in, and one of the so-called staff was actually as yet untrained apprentice. So you need, if you're looking for childcare, you do need to go and look.
You also say there should be a view of the outside. There should be the ability to go outside and play.
Yeah. I worry about childcare centres or nurseries being a very limited environment for children. And sometimes a few parents, I think, are perhaps a bit taken in by the beautiful toys and equipment, developmental toys, tiny toilets, low-down wash basins, everything beautiful. But if you think of spending all day, every weekday, in that one room, in that one environment, if you were at home with that Italian grandmother you mentioned, you'd probably be going in your buggy, out to the store, you'd probably be going to the park. I worry about it being almost more limited than being in an open plan office all day.
The way their parents are.
The way their parents are.
In your book, you talk about something that might be the panacea of childcare. It's an integrated childcare center offering care for several years and catering to children and parents. These are found in Scandinavian countries. Can you describe them? And then, you know, why haven't they, you know, taken hold here?
The idea is that you make a sort of one-stop shop for young families in a neighbourhood. You want daycare, but you also want playrooms and drop-in centres for children who are perhaps with grandparents or with other kinds of home daycare providers, or who are at home with grandchildren, or mothers who are at home and bored silly themselves. Because somewhere you can go with your small child, you know, if you do it well enough, that centre becomes not only the obvious place for daycare and play centres and playrooms and what have you, but also the obvious place to try a little children's theatre, or somebody wants to try out some new art lessons with children, or music, or whatever. We've got all this stuff going on in the community, but if they were in the centres, they'd become open to a great many more people.
What would you say to those who say, this is ridiculous, my taxpayer money shouldn't go to take care of other people's kids?
If you've got enough taxpayer money that you don't need any help providing for your own kids, which probably means either that both two parents have got to go 75% time each, or one parent's got to go half time, or even one parent's got to stay home full time. If you can afford that in the modern world, and that's what you'd like to do, then I couldn't be more for it. But for a great many parents, that isn't an option. It can't be done. And a huge burden is being placed on grandparents, many of whom nowadays need to work later themselves and are giving up jobs or going part-time in order to provide help with grandchildren. And I know it sounds lovely being looked after by your grandmother, but when you talk to a lot of those grandmothers, quite a lot of them say things like, and I quote this in the book, I love those children, heavens I do, but I don't love doing this. I thought I was finished with this. I thought I'd done my child rearing.
Yeah. And I'm quoting Sebastian Kramer, psychiatrist, in your book, saying no one can care for a child alone.
Mm-hmm. This is the modern version of it takes a village to rear a child. I don't think it takes a village, but I think you can't actually balance even two parents and two children and a full-time job and make it work. You need more backup than that. It doesn't work.
Penelope Leach, one last question. Your book came out on January 20th. That was a big day here in the U.S., Inauguration Day. Coincidence, or are you trying to send a message about the need to change policies in the U.S. when it comes to childcare?
Well, do you know, it's not for me to say, but I've got a feeling my publishers had a little sort of feeling that that was a good day to publish. I was a bit surprised. I thought media were going to be busy thinking about other things. But seriously, it is wonderful to see this change going on in the White House, and particularly interesting, of course, that it sounds as if the new way of life is going partly to be dependent on a grandmother giving those little girls a lot of their care. Yeah. And that's very interesting.
At-home childcare.
At-home childcare.
Well, there's a whole chapter in your book on it. Penelope Leach, again, the book is Childcare Today, Getting It Right for Everyone. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
And one last thing. Are you a working mom who's worried that your child will love your care provider more than you? Penelope says, not a chance. Go to our website, here-now.org, to hear her thoughts on that. A little web extra at here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, why are there overseas tax shelters? Why do some utility companies collect hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes and then keep them? We'll have thoughts on getting rid of the tax loopholes tomorrow. Coming up today, in the U.S., they're called schmatas. In Haiti, they're called Pepe. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Rags, claws, a baboon.
Rags, bones, bottles. That was the cry of the ragmen, Jewish merchants who traded in secondhand clothes and fabric at the turn of the last century. Today, they're more likely to call the rags schmatas, and the industry has expanded beyond the Jewish merchants. In fact, you may be surprised at how much American secondhand clothing is shipped overseas, in particular to impoverished Haiti, where a well-dressed man can point to everything he's wearing. It's all American secondhand, or what the Haitians call Pepe. The origin of the word Pepe is unclear, but Pepe, or secondhand clothes, began flowing into Haiti after some trade restrictions put in place to punish the Haitian dictator Duvalier were lifted. We learn this history in a fascinating new documentary short called Secondhand Pepe. It's made by Hannah Rose Schell, an assistant professor at MIT and a descendant of Jewish-Canadian rag traders. Hannah Rose, welcome.
Thanks very much.
And Vanessa Bertozzi, who's editor-in-chief at Etsy.com. That's a site dedicated to independent artists, craftspeople, and vintage dealers. Vanessa, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Hannah, we know the seed for your film was when you read a 2002 news article that claimed that of the 2.5 billion pounds of clothing donated to charity in the U.S., 80% is shipped around the world by rag traders. And at the same time, you were both shopping in secondhand stores yourself, and you started seeing women from Haiti, but they weren't looking for something to wear as much as something to send home.
Exactly. And that was really striking. The large amount of what they were doing was actually looking for very specific things that were needed in Haiti. And those clothes might end up being worn by their family members in Haiti, or they might end up being collected by those family members and sold.
And they're sort of like a micro view of this macro world that you found, which is these huge rag traders, rag dealers still buying from charities to send overseas. And your film has many narrators, but it includes a fourth-generation rag trader who's reading letters from his grandfather. And here's his grandfather telling him where the clothing came from a century ago.
Goodwill and the Salvation Army collected old usable clothing as donations starting in the 19-teens. Soon, the Christian charities started selling clothes to Jewish dealers like us. So we handled the processing, sorting, and reselling, and they made money for their social programs. Our business with the charities flourished during the Depression, and in the lucrative years after World War II, our bales began to make their way overseas.
So here you have, decades ago, the same thing happening, buying from charities and sending them overseas. But Vanessa, you remind us of the history of Haiti in particular and why the rag trade flourishes so much there. It has to do with the embargo on trade with Haiti.
Yeah, actual new manufactured clothes in Haiti, that industry no longer exists to the point where the only choice people have really is used American clothing. When Kennedy lifted the embargo and used American goods started coming into Haiti, they referred to the actual goods as Kennedy. And then it became goodwill, and then it became, in some circumstances, Reagan.
Just jumping off of what Vanessa said, I think one of the things that we discovered in making the film, and this was true both in interviewing and talking to Jewish Americans, fourth generation type immigrants, and in talking to Haitian Americans, was that the whole secondhand business, even the words that you use to talk about secondhand clothes, are something people really have a lot of ideas about, but generally have never talked about. So in the case of Haitians, really interested in kind of debating over, you know, is the right word Pepe or is it Kennedy? Is it Pepe, you know, if you don't sell it, if you give it? We found that a lot of people hadn't had a forum to talk about those things before.
Well, I want to get back to the letters that Bernard Shapiro, a rag trader, wrote decades ago, and his grandson reads for your film. And here he is describing what rag traders did as tons of used material came into their warehouses. But as we're hearing his words, we're seeing your pictures and hearing sounds from a modern-day facility, and they're doing the work just as Bernard Shapiro did it nearly 100 years ago. Let's listen.
I created separate piles for different grades of goods. For example, woolen rags in one area and cotton materials in another. Whites, numbers 1 and 2. Thirds and blues. Prints and calicos. Manila rope, seam cloth, wool seams and mixed bagging. Then all the colors and sizes of slacks, suit jackets, riding boots, women's things. And every grade had its market. Since we had no electric presses in those days, we stamped down the rags with our feet. We stamped and stamped until we had jammed a quarter ton of clothes into the baler. We tightened the wires, dragged all 500 pounds on and off the scale, and shipped them off to their various destinations.
Clothing stomped into bales? It's astonishing.
I think that's one of the most remarkable thing about in getting behind the scenes in these sorting factories was seeing the machinery and the mechanisms and the human labor that goes into the used clothing industry and how much it's still the same as was described in the memoir.
You know, it's interesting. I've been at docks. I mean, a lot of people have been down to see container ships. Now I realize what those brightly colored bales are, Hannah. These huge tons of crushed clothing. But you went to Haiti. What's it like when these bales arrive at the dock in Haiti?
Gosh, what's it like? It's, that was another...
It's like a plane dropped, like five planes dropped these bales on top of a port town in Haiti, and they just exploded, and it's covering the entire town.
Right.
Honestly, these marketplaces, and you can see this in the film, it's just stacks and stacks and heaps of used colorful clothing with, largely Haitian women sorting and resorting, and then peddlers carrying off bushels of clothing on their heads and to distribute them throughout the country.
And Hannah, tell us what they do with the clothing, because they don't just put it on as is.
No, I think the clothing really becomes something that at least struck me as being a little bit like a almost a raw material, like a resource that sort of takes on so many different kinds of new lives. And for some people, it becomes something to just wear quite directly. But for most people, it becomes something that is bought and then altered and then sold and then resold and carried by one person and then another person and then another person from one village to another. And it becomes a little bit like something like a currency. I mean, kind of like portable value, which can be traded, which can be saved, which can be cut up and turned into something else, a quilt. In our film, there's one sequence where a woman who was actually trained as a seamstress, as a fashion designer, talks about the way in which she takes secondhand American clothes and recuts them and refashions them to sort of fit her body and then to fit other people's bodies.
And this shirt that she cuts, that she makes short sleeves, she puts darts in it, is beautiful when she's finished with it.
It's really beautiful. And there is an argument that's made sometimes that the flow of these clothes from the first world to the third world, as in the case of Haiti, is across the board bad. An example of free trade, which has an effect of hurting both culture and economic success in the third world. And one of the things that was so striking is actually that, although to some extent that may be true in many places, what one really sees is just the remarkable amount of of positive things that come out of these clothes.
And the ingenuity. I mean, Pepe refers not just to used clothing, but to any American used goods that make their way to the country.
In fact, in your film, we see things like television sets and mattresses. We're talking about the film Secondhand Pepe. You're listening to Here and Now. And Vanessa, we were just talking about the fact that Pepe is more than clothing, but it's the images of these huge bales of clothing going overseas that make such a statement. You always hear comments in America like, I go to Africa and I want to feel as if I'm in Africa, and instead I see kids running around with Larry Bird t-shirts. And your film explains how those t-shirts got there. But some people see this as a downside, you know, the American billboard aspect of Pepe, with people wearing slogans and images that don't at all relate to their culture.
There's always been a secondhand clothing trade, and there's always been people with more money's clothes ending up on the back of people with less money.
I think that there is something that is jarring about seeing, you know, watching the news and seeing the footage from a developing country and seeing, you know, seeing the people there wearing, you know, a t-shirt from your high school sports team or something like that. And what we wanted to do was go and move to the other side of that screen and talk to those people about their experiences wearing those items of clothing. And it's very complex because on the one side, some of them are aware of which brand is hip and, you know, which item of clothing is high quality, what's going to last my family through this season. And but at the same time, I think it's, you know, when we talk to the seamstress who used to design her own original patterns and make more of a traditional Haitian style of garment, you know, it's difficult to hear her say that there's no business for her anymore because it's too expensive.
And people would rather have her rework Pepe. But I just also want to point out that Americans might see a negative to this, but to Haitians, I mean, you heard from people who said, this is such an opportunity for Haitians to finally be able to look like the people they see in the movies, to them to dress up in a way. Bernard Shapiro, again, his grandson, Bill Shapiro, is reading his letters, who did this 100 years ago, spoke of there being a stigma. Let's listen.
Rags to riches. These were the stories at the old Nickelodeon in Baltimore. The theater was only two blocks away from the warehouse where we sorted and baled the rag mountains from sunup to sundown. Fancy people avoided the theater, for in those days it was believed that immigrants and their rags were contagious with all kinds of foreign disease.
And Vanessa, you found that there was a stigma of kind of a different kind in Haiti to secondhand clothes, at least initially.
Yeah, at the same time that secondhand clothing is everywhere and visible as you walk down any street, there's usually vendors selling Pepe. At the very same time, some of the people wanted to go to a private shop in the, say, the back room of somebody's home and buy their Pepe in privacy. One of the things that we saw a whole lot of when we were in Port-au-Prince were dry cleaners. And there was this almost spiritual aspect to the used clothing in that the idea was to sort of wring it free of its former life to make it one's own.
There was a lot of feeling not only about how to clean the clothing or in the dry cleaning aspect, but just the idea of what can't you even remove once you've cleaned it. In other words, you know, if the woman before you who wore the wedding dress had an unhappy wedding or left a stain that you can't get out with the dry cleaning, does that bode anything for your own experience wearing the clothes? And it reminds me a lot of my own mother or grandmother. My grandmother can't stand secondhand clothing because, you know, she grew up extremely poor on the Lower East Side, wearing only secondhand clothing. And then, you know, after the Holocaust, they associate secondhand clothing a lot with dead people and with something that you're trying to run away from.
Well, I should say my mother ran a secondhand clothing shop. And Vanessa, you were saying that, you know, there was a stigma for some people. There still is. I mean, secondhand clothing shops in the U.S. become secret clubs for women who, you know, maybe don't want to acknowledge that they're on hard financial times or, you know, they have to sell their clothes or buy clothing secondhand. And it becomes a real sort of woman-to-woman network at times. I mean, it's just, you've really tapped a vein here with secondhand clothing. There's just so much to explore. Hannah Rochelle and Vanessa Bertozzi. Their film about the rag trade, both over 100 years ago and today in Haiti, is called Secondhand Pepe. For more about the film, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Hannah, Vanessa, thank you both.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Secondhand
Of course, Fanny Bryce's classic version of Secondhand Rose. Coming up, the Utah college kid who crashed a government land auction in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. You could file our next story under the heading, What Were They Thinking? There was Tim DeChristopher on December 19th in Salt Lake City, Utah, at a federal government land auction attended by oil and gas companies. He was holding up his paddle, number 70, driving up bids, and ultimately acquiring the right to drill on 22,000 acres of Utah wilderness. But DeChristopher is not a company. He's a 27-year-old senior at the University of Utah. He had no intention of and no resources to buy anything. Federal officials weren't happy. Tim joins us from KUER in Salt Lake. And Tim, take us back. This was a controversial land auction, an 11th-hour Bush administration move to open up drilling in southern Utah land that may be energy-rich but is definitely spectacular red rock wilderness within sight of two national parks. So what did you go to the auction intending to do?
Well, I went there intending to cause as much of a disruption as I could.
Uh-huh.
I knew that there was a protest going on outside, and I'd been following a lot of the opposition to this auction as soon as it was announced, when they were trying to slide it in under the radar.
Well, now, how did you get into the auction?
Well, I went down there to the protest, and I decided I was going to go inside, and an official said, "Hi, are you here for the auction?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "Are you here as a bidder?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am." And she said, "Okay, just have a seat and fill out this form, and all I need to see is a driver's license."
Was it just, was each moment just compelling you along? Well, they let me in. Well, I might as well go in. Well, they're letting me hold up my paddle. I might as well bid. Well, I won one. I might as well keep going. Was it?
I was just trying to get inside. And it wasn't until I got inside the auction room that I saw that I could have a major effect by bidding and driving up the prices.
Well, and officials finally figured out what you were up to. They made you sign a form vowing to pay for what you'd bid on. They told you you owed them $45,000 as a first payment on the $1.8 million worth of land that you won. And then they threw you out. Well, then what happened? Because, you're potentially in serious trouble. This is fraud. You misrepresented yourself. You disrupted the auction. There's legitimate businesses, that were pushed out of this because of you, and you can't pay for this.
Well, in fact, I didn't even have to misrepresent myself. There was a form that said, "Who do you represent?" And I wrote, "Tim DeChristopher." And the first time that anyone asked me what my intentions were there or whether I had the intent to pay, I told them honestly. I told them that I was there to disrupt the auction, but that was already after the fact.
Well, but we understand that once they told you that you had to pay, you started to get support and donations from as far away as Norway?
I got donations from around the country, from Japan, Hungary, places like that.
You've got a website, bidder70, that again, your paddle.org. Mm-hmm. How much has been raised so far?
Around $110,000.
Well, let's say where you are now in your story. You offered to make your first payment on the land, but you didn't get a response from the Bureau. But since then, other things have changed as well, completely separate from your case. A U.S. district judge in Washington, D.C. has responded to a suit from environmental groups, and he's put a restraining order on the sale of the land in Utah, saying the Bush administration didn't do sufficient environmental impact analysis. What does that do to you?
That's great news for me. That was a temporary restraining order, and if it does become permanent, one, it means that they can't accept my payment on the land, and it means for my legal case that there's no actual harm caused. And it's just a question of my intent at the time, because I did make it clear that my intent was to disrupt the auction. But it's also an official statement that this was an inappropriate auction and that these lands shouldn't have been put up for sale.
Well, but, if everybody just acted on impulse and, let's say you were having a gathering that you felt passionately about and somebody came in and disrupted it because they didn't. I mean, isn't there something to be said to going through other channels? I mean, you get what I'm saying.
I do get what you're saying, but, the other side, the fossil fuel industry, doesn't have to resort to actions like this because they're the ones who write the rules. That's why they buy so many congressmen, so that they get to make the rules that work for them. And so when those who seek to destroy get to write the rules, those who seek to protect have to find ways of working outside of those rules.
Tim DeChristopher, a 27-year-old economics major at the University of Utah. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, a heads up to our new listeners today in Springfield, Massachusetts, that a Main Street fixture is about to close. As part of our occasional look at how Main Street is hit hard by the economy with no bailout, we've called up Alan Ardito of Boston Seafoods, a family-owned shop which is closing this weekend after 62 years in business. Alan, why are you closing?
Well, basically, over the years, we've seen what I'll call the dynamics of the business change. You know, I use the term Wally World or Walmart World, where the small market concept that I've always been involved in is becoming a dinosaur. We're becoming a thing of the past. It's that one-stop shopping concept that that is really very difficult for the specialized type of business to compete with.
But, you know, if you go to a box store in many cases, you're not getting fresh-caught fish. You're getting frozen fish.
There's a definite compromise in quality. You know, you're right. You're making that concession. So you find the small market going the way of the small hardware store and the small drug store that we remember that used to be on every corner.
Boy, 62 years in the same place, it must have been a tough decision to throw in the towel.
Very difficult. There was actually a fish market here since 1923. My father and my uncle started here in 1947, right after World War II. I was still a junior in high school and began working here at that time part-time. But I actually have been hanging around here even before that.
How many employees will now also be out of work?
8 people.
Yeah, well, and we understand some of them have been with you. Well, one employee started with your dad 50 years ago. He's 81 now. And that Joanne Gagne, I think, has been there for 36 years. Is she standing by there? We'd love to talk to her.
Joanne's right here. Joanne, want to pick up?
Hi, Joanne. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but you're looking at unemployment.
Yes, I am. Yeah, after 36 years.
36 years at the same store. Why'd you stay there so long?
It's a wonderful atmosphere. You know, I can honestly say I've come to work happy every day. It's a great family atmosphere with your coworkers, the customers we're so close to. That's probably the hardest part of leaving, is leaving the customers.
Well, I'm sure you hear from customers who said, yeah, but I can get it cheaper at Walmart, or I don't want to come downtown anymore. I mean, what would you say to people is the benefit of your store over the other choices they're making?
I think we have a high-quality product here, and a lot of people agree with me on that. But unfortunately, in today's climate, not enough can take the time to do that, as Alan said previously.
What have customers who have stayed been saying to you?
That they're so sorry. We've had some tears. It's been a very difficult emotional change with the customers.
Well, Joanne, we wish you the best. I'm wondering if you can hand me back to Alan.
Certainly. Hold on 1 minute.
Thanks. Well, Alan, what are you going to do now?
Well, as far as myself goes, I've still got a building that I've got to that I have to find either a renter or a buyer for. I've got more inventory that I have to liquidate. When it's all done, then I'll have to sit back and maybe reevaluate my own life and see what direction I want to go in. I guess if I was to develop a resume, which I've never needed before in my life, it would be rather limited. You know, 50 years of selling fish.
Alan Ardito of Boston Seafoods, closing its doors this weekend after 62 years. The city offered him a loan, but he's afraid it'll prolong the inevitable. So, Alan, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
So to our new listeners in Springfield on WNNZ 640 AM, welcome. And as you just heard, you've got just this week to pick up your scrod at Allen's. We also want to welcome listeners in West Lafayette, Indiana on WBAA 920 AM. Thank you so much for trying us out. Let us know stories you want covered in your area or weird fish you have. Scrod is just a young cod or haddock. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston, home of the bean and the cod, often also called scrod. That's a whole other fish story. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.